This is the Unconquered Podcast. Unbiased, unrivaled, and unconquered coverage and analysis of Florida State football.
If Florida State,
we won national championships and ACC championships.
It's caught! Touchdown official, Kelvin Benjamin!
Back to some basics, consistency in what we're doing. Guys getting a little banged and bruised, working a bunch of different situations, making progress.
You have to have success so you know something I can really do this.
Game over! Those are the champions of college football!
Jameis, why? Jameis, no! No! No!
Welcome to the Unconquered Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Staples. Today's episode, we're going to talk a little bit about the off-the-field stuff that has been surrounding Florida State, that has become the center of attention when talking about Florida State, particularly from the national media. And we'll talk about some of the issues surrounding that, from SEC bias or supposed SEC bias to a range of other things. Now, first of all, I want to mention, I want to basically get this out front, is how frustrating it has been to cover Florida State this year as a football reporter, as someone who wants to focus on what's going on the field. I want to do X's and O's. I want to talk about what's happening scheme-wise. I want to get back to talking about football. I mean, Sam Ponder tweeted out earlier this week something very similar, saying, just once, I would love to cover a Florida State game where the focus is on what's happening on the field. And I can't echo that more strongly. It's very frustrating to have essentially turned into TMZ over the course of the last few months. Basically, Florida State has drawn attention and has received in other cases some attention probably that was undeserved off the field more than what's been going on the field. I mean, there's been some obviously coverage of the number two team in the country on the field, but the bulk of the attention has been on particularly Jameis Winston off the field, and then obviously some other issues as well. I want to talk a little bit though about how those things are covered and why some of the perceptions out there aren't exactly right. Why there's some differences between the way that Florida State gets covered and some other programs. I do think that there's a certain amount of bias out there, but we need to understand what's actually happening and the reason for some of this bias that we see, rather than just jumping to conclusions and jumping into sweeping conspiracy theory type stuff like what I've seen out there quite a bit. The first thing to address is that if we're going to understand the way that Florida State has been covered, it has more than anything been dominated and influenced by the rape allegations against Jameis Winston stemming from a sexual encounter with a Florida State co-ed in late 2012. Everybody knows this, but I think at some level, a lot of people, particularly Florida State fans, don't quite understand how much that continues to dominate the public conscience or the public consciousness of this particular team and of Winston in general, and of the national media, of the consciousness of the national media as well. These national people have not read the case files like many Florida State fans out there have. I mean, if you're interested in Florida State and you want to make sure that you're rooting for a team that doesn't include a rapist, then you certainly want to make sure that that things have been taken care of and that this person is not a rapist. And my guess is that most Florida State fans and also people within the Florida State program have no interest in rooting for a rapist. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But obviously a lot of Florida State fans have more of an interest in checking into the facts of the case and making sure that they know exactly what's been going on with that. Whereas if you're a national media person, or especially if you're just a random person, a random onlooker, a football fan nationally, and you hear about these allegations, and particularly the way that Winston's accusers legal team basically held press conferences to try to release these allegations and to try to shape the media narrative, which they did fairly successfully, despite being fairly incompetent. Patricia Carroll's performances in those press conferences were legendarily poor, but because those were the only real discussion, since Winston's side really didn't say anything other than, well, yeah, I mean, he and she had sex, it was consensual, and that's it. They didn't really say much beyond that. So what ends up happening is that the narrative gets shaped early on. And one thing we know is that once a narrative gets out there, it's really, really hard to change that narrative. A good example of this goes back to Columbine. My listeners out there probably remember the Columbine school shootings years and years ago. And there's this sort of myth, this legend of Cassie Bernal, who reportedly in early reports after the Columbine shootings, the story goes that basically Cassie had been under a table or something like that, and then I think the one shooter's name was Dylan, but either way, one of the shooters came over and he asked her, "Do you believe in God?" And Cassie said, "Yes," and then he basically shot her in the head. And this was latched onto by all sorts of evangelical Christians who wanted to, who looked at this as a sort of modern martyrdom. And they held up Cassie's bold faith as an example of how to respond, of how to stand up for the faith, even when there's a threat of death. But as it turns out, not very long after the Columbine, after these initial reports, which then, launched songs and conferences and all sorts of things about this, someone else came forward and said, "Well, I was actually with Cassie when she died, and that didn't happen." And then someone else came forward and said, "Actually, I was the one that was asked, do you believe in God? And I'm actually still alive." This is the whole story got garbled in initial reporting, and it shaped an entire narrative and a whole movement for a while, that to the point that now a lot of people out there, if you mention Cassie Bernal, they still know the "Do You Believe in God" story, and if the one thing that's remembered for a lot of people about Columbine happens to be that, but it's a complete myth. It was something that was shaped in the earliest reports of the Columbine incident, and because it was shaped early on, that's the truth for a lot of people. And actually, what's interesting is that Cassie's church and some others, when they were confronted with the evidence that didn't happen, they basically said, "We don't really care. This is what we choose to believe, that this happened." And that's how it is for a lot of people. Once the narrative is set, it's much harder to re-examine a narrative that you've already accepted than it is to accept a narrative to begin with. So what's happened is Winston very early got pegged as someone who got away with rape. That became the narrative. That became what people were going to focus on. And as a result, no matter what happens regarding Jameis Winston, the one thing that people remember is that this is somebody that got away with rape. And so as a result, once he does anything else, whether it's walk out of a Publix without paying for crab legs and crawfish, whether it's, standing up and shouting an insanely stupid internet meme that of all people, he's the last person in America that should have done that. There's no doubt about that. We are on the record at Null Digest. I made it very clear that I thought that the suspension that he got was warranted just for stupidity, for not understanding that the implications of doing that sort of thing in that environment and in his place. But at the same time, what's happened with him is that no matter what, there's always that overhanging, that overshadowing thought that this is somebody who got away with rape. Now, we've spent a lot of time going through the files. We've spent a lot of time going through and getting to the bottom of the case as much as possible. And we've concluded that there's very little chance, and I would say next to no chance, that Winston got away with rape. If anything, I think the only crime that was committed – in this whole environment, in this whole encounter, was when Chris Kasher came in trying to shoot video of this girl having sex with Jameis Winston. I think that that was a traumatic thing. I think that that's the sort of thing that you do not expect if you are someone who is who's gone back in a one night stand with a guy. You don't expect his, you know, his roommate to come in and ask if you want him to join in, and then, you know, after you kick him out the first time, to come back in and start recording. Those are serious violations of privacy. Those are traumatic. Those are, you know, recording lewd act without consent is a felony. It's a felony in the state of Florida. So I think that there's little doubt based on the case files that there was a crime committed. But given the we've been through this over and over again, given the fact that the talk screen says that she was not impaired, that her story is that she was impaired. She was overly impaired. She couldn't give consent. And essentially that she sort of was in and out of consciousness and, you know, basically was found herself having sex with this guy and then just sort of came out of the fugue state sometime after he dropped her off of his scooter on campus near her place. That's the story. The problem is that the toxicology screen and the blood alcohol content tests that were taken 3 hours after the alleged incident were clean. Well, that's a smoking gun. That, at that point, you don't have impairment. And her friends, when they were interviewed by law enforcement, said, well, no, she wasn't impaired when she left the bar. So essentially it stops being a he said, she said, which is how this is often characterized. It stops being a he said, she said, and it starts being a she said versus the evidence and her friends and then eyewitnesses and what he says. And at that point, that's an unsustainable case. That's why state attorney Willie Meggs, didn't take the case. That's why he didn't make charges, because you can't charge if it's just one person's word against the scientific tests, against the forensics, and against the witnesses of who should be on, you know, who would be thought to be most likely to be in her favor, and then also potential eyewitnesses. You can't do that. So given that, we know that. We in the Florida State community, those of us who've spent a lot of time looking at this, know that. But I've done some national interviews. I've done some, you know, some talks about this on national radio, and I've been surprised by how little the national hosts have known about some of this stuff. But when I actually thought about it, it made sense. They don't have the time. They don't have the interest to go in and look at a 240 plus page state attorney's file to determine whether or not Jameis Winston actually got away with rape. They don't actually have the interest in looking at that. So they're just looking at a few national stories about what's happened. And so the narrative that they got early on in the case has already been set. Now, what that means is that Florida State is already operating from behind when it comes to public relations, when it comes to the overall impression of Florida State nationally. There's no doubt about that, that they're operating from behind because of these Winston allegations. And it really is sad in many ways that the Tallahassee Police Department did not investigate the allegations more thoroughly within the first few hours, because they may have found Chris Kasher before too long and found the video that he shot, which, you know, apparently was only a few seconds and didn't show very much. He said, you know, the girl hadn't even been visible, but my guess is with proper video editing and so on, you can lighten up the dark background and all that, and you can figure out what's actually happening. So, you know, at that point, you've got a clear answer, and from all indications, Winston would have been completely cleared. Now, Kasher would have been on the hook for recording it, but Winston would have been cleared. And at that point, you have a totally different thing. But that didn't happen. And so once you have then a top team in the country, which is what Florida State came into this year as, the number one team in the country, the most notorious team in the country, effectively, because of the Winston bit, you put all that together, and as soon as you're number one, the microscope, the magnifying glass gets that much bigger, because now you're the team that everybody's going to be talking about all year anyway. So to some extent, that's just par for the course. When that comes with the territory when you are a number one team. When you're a national champion, everybody is starting to dig around to find out what's going on. And this is part of what it is to be a celebrity in America. Is when you become a celebrity, everybody loves you, but they also want to find out all your dirt. They're digging through your garbage. They want to find out, they're trying to hack your phone and find out and release nudes of you and do all sorts of things to show that you are just that you're not what people think. But at the same point, you have this ambivalence towards celebrity in the United States, where people love their celebrities, but they also there's also a constant push to tear them down. That's what happens when you're on top of the college football world. That's what Florida State is. They're on top of the college football world right now, and they happen to have somebody for whom the narrative that was set early is that of sexual assault. So then you take that, and Florida State, no matter what, is going to be operating from behind. You add that to a climate right now which is dealing tremendously with all sorts of issues of violence and particularly violence and disrespect towards women in the world of sports and particularly football. Football gets singled out because it's a violent game. It's the one that everybody wants to highlight as the barbaric game that Americans play. So football ends up being the one that gets focused on. I mean, you have domestic violence issues and sexual assault issues and all of that across all sorts of sports, and that includes women's sports, actually. This is not isolated to football. This is a cultural problem. We have a rape culture. There is a culture of violence toward women. All you have to do is go into Twitter and take a look at what men are, and not just men, but mostly men, what people are tweeting at women, particularly in the media, and it's filthy. It's obscene. It's vile. It's violent. We have a problem with these things in our culture. We have a problem in our popular music. Listen to what these people are saying in popular music about women and how women are essentialized as essentially sex objects to be dominated. That is accepted in a large portion of our popular music. It's not examined. And actually, there's an article I just finished in Slate that made the comment. It was about a different thing, but it made the comment that racism often ends up being something that that goes about trying to cover over sexism. That sexism gets tolerated because of racism, because you don't want to criticize people of color, so you tolerate the misogyny and rap and hip hop and things like that get a free pass. And then someone like Jameis Winston, who steps up and says something that is in popular music all the time, that sort of thing that's in popular music all the time, he gets blamed. He gets the blame for a culture that's much larger and wider than he is. And I think that has happened in large measure in many of our in much of the music that we've accepted. There was a Supreme Court case recently where someone had threatened, had made some basically death threats toward his ex-wife on Facebook, and then was arrested for making those threats, and then basically said, well, no, those were song lyrics that I was working on. I was just working, that's part of the genre. And, basically that was the defense. And at that point, it's potentially a First Amendment issue where you have freedom of expression and you can express those threats in music potentially if that's the genre. That's the argument. But should we have genres where you're allowed to threaten women, where you're allowed to be hostile to women? No, I mean, that's a problem, right? We have a cultural problem of respect for women. We have a cultural problem of misogyny. We have a cultural problem of sexual assault and of rape and of violence toward women. There's no doubt about that. This is not just a football problem. But football is getting the microscope because it's the most popular sport. It's a violent sport. It's, all of these things. It's an easy target for that. And so all of this that we've seen from the Florida State side happens to coincide with that. So that's just going to make the attention hotter. Then we add, basically the New York Times coming into town. And the thing that's interesting is that the New York Times and these national entities, what they can't do is they can't do what some of us on the local side have done, and that's go through the case and determine, well, it's pretty clear that he did not rape this young lady. They can't really say that and then print that, because then you have the sense that and something that we've been blamed before, we've avoided this, but you have that idea of blaming the victim, of not believing an alleged victim. And now, you know, all of a sudden that basically becomes, you get accused. The impression is that you are a further part of the lack of respect for women in the culture because you're not believing a rape victim. And it's true that a lot of rape victims don't get believed. That they're legitimately raped, they're legitimately assaulted, and they aren't given the credibility that they deserve, often by law enforcement. There's studies on this that are very clear. But when you look at this case, it's a fairly cut and dry case once you actually see the data, once you actually see the story together with the forensics and some of these other things. But what you can't do typically in the national media is anything that's going to shed a potentially negative light on a potential victim of sexual assault. So you're not going to see someone analyze the case and go, well, it's pretty clear that he didn't do it, because that it's not a climate where you can do that. So then what happens? If you want to continue writing on this, what you do is you start to dig around and you try to find evidence of systemic problems, of a systemic cultural problem. And so Florida State has been getting the Duke lacrosse treatment of late. That's essentially what's happened, is Florida State has become the Duke lacrosse program, and people are digging around to find evidence of all sorts of, you know, boys behaving badly and, you know, the institution trying to cover over for them. So you have the New York Times case and all of these others, that, you know, the New York Times piece trying to emphasize that Florida State players get away with all sorts of things with the Tallahassee Police Department and law enforcement, and that Florida State's basically allowing their football players to run amok. Now, I think those who have been in Tallahassee for very long know that that's pretty much not true. It's absolutely true that, you know, athletes and college students as well get away with a lot of shenanigans in a college town. There's no doubt about that. It happens in every college town, and it happens wherever there's big time sports. So, you know, the things like BB gun fights and that sort of thing, there's no doubt that stuff has happened. You know, there were paintball fights as far back as when I was on the football team that, you know, involved a couple times police getting called out to Burt Reynolds Hall and addressing, you know, potential property damage and that sort of thing. That has a long history. But when it comes to violent crimes, when it comes to actual stuff, ask Greg Dent, Greg Reed, Jarman Fortson, Arrington Jenkins, Avis Comac, these guys who all got kicked off of the Florida State team for actual run-ins with the law, for actual for failing drug tests, for actual behavior that was not right. Ira Denson, another one, for misbehavior. It's not like Florida State has been running amok in that sense. But what has happened is Winston was not thrown to the wolves for an allegation. And since that has basically shaped the narrative, anything else can be used anecdotally to say, well, see, you know, they let, you know, this BB gun thing was allowed to slide. So obviously that means that, you know, they're going to let somebody like Winston slide, and, you know, they're not comparable. But what the New York Times can't do because of the climate, like I said, is analyze the Winston case. So they're going to do a guilt by association, which is what they did. Now, finally, what I want to get to before we finish is I want to talk a little bit about, well, two things, actually. I want to talk a little bit about the Carlos Williams situation. Carlos Williams, from what I can tell, based on the pictures, probably did grab this young lady, his pregnant girlfriend, who apparently they're not together anymore. They at one point were live-in. There seemed to be potentially some indication from her Twitter feed, which I had seen almost immediately after those pictures had posted, that there were some complaints about a potential other girl involved in all of this. So that, you know, this may be a triangle situation. But it's probable, based on the bruise pattern that I saw in those pictures, which the bruises were nasty, it's probable, in my view, that Carlos Williams grabbed this girl probably pretty roughly by the upper arm. What we don't know is the situation. We don't know if she was attacking another girl, if she was trying to hit him. We don't know any of these situations. What it doesn't look like to me is that he actually hit her. It doesn't look like he struck her. It looks like he grabbed her upper arm kind of violently, probably jerked her away from something, away from himself, away. We don't know. But it looks like that there was some sort of contact. We don't know much about what happened. We just know that there were pictures that were posted. We know that there were some accusations attached to those pictures, basically directed. It doesn't mention Carlos Williams by name, but it sort of looks like it's directed at Williams by implication. And basically there's a sense that that it has to do with some interaction between them. We don't know what actually happened there. I think that this is why there needs to be further investigation if you're the Tallahassee Police Department. And it's why, by the way, you know, there's no surprise that the alleged victim was upset when this got reported to the Tallahassee Police Department. It apparently was reported to Florida State by a third party. The woman's attorney says that Florida State then reported the third-party report then to the Tallahassee Police Department, who then is at an obligation legally to investigate a potential domestic violence situation. So basically, at that point, it's out of the victim's hands. She cannot choose to charge or not to charge, to press charges, any of that stuff. It's in the hands of the state, because domestic cases are they involve situations where victims most often tend to want charges not to be put forth for a number of reasons, either fear of reprisal or concern about losing a meal ticket, which would certainly be, you know, a potential issue in this case, all sorts of things. So it's then the state's responsibility to investigate as thoroughly as possible and then determine whether or not charges are going to be brought by the state against the potential abuser. So that's going to happen no matter what. That's going to be investigated. That investigation is going to continue. It's going to be difficult because the woman says she will not cooperate with the investigation. She's not going to talk to investigators. She has no interest in this. So it probably is going to wind up with nothing. It's going to end up being a gray area, which, you know, we won't end up knowing what happened with Carlos Williams and this pregnant young lady. And of course, that's going to be a situation where everybody's going to cry for Florida State to suspend Williams, to do whatever, to kick him off the team or do something to get blood. But you have a third party report that doesn't have any witnesses in that case, and the alleged victim won't speak to investigators. You have nothing you can actually justly suspend or boot a kid for. And if you do suspend or boot a kid for that sort of thing, you're now setting an unsustainable precedent for running your team, because that gives rivals, that gives people who may not like a kid or whatever, all of a sudden the incentive to make an accusation and get a kid suspended or booted for something that he didn't do. So you can't set that precedent. It also cuts your throat on the recruiting trail. I thought it was very interesting that Jacquez Patrick, the number three running back in the country, who just committed to Florida State this week, commented that his family had been paying very close attention to how Jimbo Fisher had handled the Jameis Winston situation, and that how Fisher has stepped up and defended Winston in the press and in the face of a tremendous amount of pressure to, you know, crack down on Winston for, you know, shouting obscenities or for whatever, you know, or for, you know, ESPN Darren Rovell's allegations that Winston must have gotten money for all of the autographs that were authenticated. You've got to do something. Fisher has stepped forward and defended them. And Jacquez Patrick said that went a long way with my mom. That mattered a lot to her, you know, because she knew that he would step up and defend me if I was falsely accused of something. Well, you know, that's the sort of thing you have to do if you're Florida State. But the thing is, nationally, because the narrative is set by the Winston thing, there's nothing you can do that's gonna satisfy the media, because the only thing you can do that's gonna satisfy the media and the national public that isn't aware of the facts of the cases is to eliminate these guys. They want blood. They want them torn down. And to do so as a way of signaling, it's really about signaling. I mean, this is a sociological phenomenon. It's really about signaling respect for women. It's really about signaling how seriously we take sexual assault. But the problem is, you can't just choose a random accusation to signal that. What you need to do is you need to crack down where there's actual evidence of sexual assault, where there's clear indications of some of unambiguous domestic violence, those things you crack down on and you have zero tolerance for. There's no room for disrespect for women, period. And that's why I think it was good that Florida State suspended Winston for shouting the obscenities that he did, for shouting the obscene meme that he did. You have to respect women, period. And if you have any evidence of otherwise, then you take action on it. But if you don't have evidence of that, you can't do anything. You can't just signal, we respect women, we don't have room for this, we're going to signal how seriously we take this by just sort of randomly taking action. You can't really do that. So that's the situation Florida State's in. You know, and I can see why, you know, at this point, given what we know, I can see why, you know, you're going to see Carlos Williams play. There's just no indication that he did anything illegal. There's no indication that he actually beat this girl. And if he did grab her, we don't know what for. I also know that my mom, for example, bruises just like that if you look at her the wrong way. If she sits down just a little bit roughly on a chair, the bruises that she gets up with are remarkable. It's just the way that certain things are. So, again, even there, we don't know exactly what the situation is. So, there's no way of rushing to judgment or making a snap judgment that's going to be just there. Finally, then you have the allegations that have swirled in the media about Carlos Williams potentially being linked to an armed robbery as a result of a drug deal that, you know, he was alleged to be the contact for, that he connected a retired Marine with someone with whom he could buy weed. And then this person and two accomplices robbed this person at gunpoint. And the man named Carlos Williams as the person who had helped him make contact with this drug dealer, and there was some implication apparently in the state attorney's case that the victim thought that perhaps Williams had been connected to the attempted robbery. The problem is that the state attorney actually didn't think that there was really anything to that. You know, Williams lawyered up as I would, and chose not to speak to law enforcement in that case because, you know, they didn't need him under subpoena to actually to do that. They asked him to come in about the investigation, and, you know, if there's one thing I know from my legal friends, it's that in those situations you get a lawyer and you don't speak. Unfortunately, that's the way it works. But the state attorney decided that they didn't need to talk to Winston in order to prosecute the case. They didn't feel that he was actually connected with the robbery, so they just moved forward. And that's that. There's no real evidence of anything there either. So at that point, again, you have lots of smoke, lots of allegations, and there's probably something there. I mean, it's probable that this guy knew Williams, and that Williams may have hooked him up with this other guy, but we don't know anything beyond that. Well, you know, at that point, again, what are you going to do? What we do know is that where there have been clear instances where there's been wrongdoing, Jimbo Fisher and the Florida State program have shown a clear protocol to actually hold these guys accountable. When there hasn't been evidence, when there hasn't been a clear indication that there's been wrongdoing, they haven't done that. They've stood by their players. They're taking a very clear, innocent until proven guilty kind of mentality with their players. And that's really what I would do. It's the only thing you really can do as a coach. It's never going to be popular with the national media to do that sort of thing. And in particular, if you have the Winston sexual assault narrative that's dominating things, but that's just the way it is. What I do not think is that this is a sort of SEC bias that is trying to tear Florida State down. I don't see that. I don't think it's even plausible. ESPN has $3.6 billion invested in the ACC. They own the entire inventory for the ACC, as opposed to a limited portion of the inventory of the SEC, which is shared with CBS. They have a very high interest, a high dollar interest in making sure that the ACC is relevant and draws viewers. Florida State is by far the most popular and most valuable ACC football team, without question. It is in ESPN's interest to have a strong Florida State to offset what is a strong SEC. There's no doubt the SEC is strong. Look at their recruiting ratings over the last few years. There's no doubt. What ESPN is going to want is they're going to want various programs. Ideally, they're going to want national programs, and if they could have their choice, they'd probably want Big Ten programs, given the level of fandom in the Midwest and the size of some of the Big Ten schools' alumni bases. They'd probably want an Ohio State or a Michigan to be the team that they can set aside and they can set alongside those SEC teams. But the bottom line is they're going to want to be able to put attention on Florida State. They want to make sure that Florida State is want Florida State to be there. They want Notre Dame to be there. They want those teams to be there. They they have an interest in the SEC being good as well, but that's just a fact. The SEC has been good for a while. So, you know, this idea that FSU is sort of being vilified because of an SEC bias, I think is thoroughly implausible. What I think is more plausible, much more likely, is that Florida State is basically, they're going to get the attention because they're good for viewers, but the narrative of the Winston sexual assault so thoroughly overshadows everything at the national level that that's what people are going to write about. And since the magnifying glass gets bigger when you are the number one program, or number two program, or the defending, the reigning national champions. When you are that, the magnifying glass gets focused on you, and then all this other stuff becomes the stuff that you cover. So yeah, you know, stuff has gone on at Alabama, and nobody's talking about Nick Marshall's past at Auburn at this point, but they're not number one. They're just part of the SEC. So you're talking about, who's going to win the SEC. That's the interesting thing. With Florida State, Florida State's getting the attention, which is what ESPN wants. But because of some of these things and because of the way that the Winston situation has influenced that narrative, you basically have other incentives, other factors at play. It's a bigger story. It's something that people are more likely to be able to pontificate about and give different opinions about and that sort of thing. And that's what the TV networks really want. So I don't buy that it's an SEC bias that's dominating the reason that Florida State gets the coverage they do. I do think that this is a mixture of politics and the sort of the zeitgeist, the spirit of the day, the things that are really hot button issues societally, and that there just happens to be a situation at Florida State that people can sort of put their finger on and do that with a team that they already want to put attention on. All right, well, that's going to be our show for today, and that's going to be the episode. This has been Jason Staples on behalf of the rest of the Noel Digest staff. This has been the Unconquered Podcast. We'll be back with you soon. I made this.